that, I'm sorry, that was Look Out, Here Comes the Tracer Bullet, and before that was Tracer Bullet's Lonely Sounds of Goodbye from the same release. That is a self-release from Tracer Bullet, so you're going to have to check them out and try to get that one right from the source. Before that, Tex Railers' Doomstown from the Battle of Bunker Hillbilly, and Upstate and Gringo Surf Radio, the name of that tune. Before that, of course, you heard from Three Bad Jacks and some tunes from their latest release, Pictures and Memories from Home. You heard Nora and Jacob's song and 1222. Okay, next we're going to do some Coffin Cats, which will carry us through the end of the program for today. This has been the Wrecking Hours Rockabilly Psychabilly Radio program. I am your friendly neighborhood beatnik Gothabilly Man with you signing off for this Monday. Hopefully you're having fun in the sun, and there are still some rain showers expected here and there throughout the rest of the evening, but wanted to let you know that Thursday, May 24th, this coming Thursday, the GD Gallows are playing with Bristol County Vultures at Smalls, and next week, May 31st, is going to be the last night for the Detroit Psychobilly Alliance Psychobilly Night at Smalls on Thursday, taking about a month off or so for all the crazy shows happening in June. And June 6th, Wednesday, a couple weeks from now, the Gutter Ghouls are going to be playing down in Riverview at the Rack and Roll. Gutter Ghouls, a new psychobilly ensemble that you might want to check out. And after that, of course, we're having the June 24th is Cash Rally and the Downright Daddies with Jane Rose and the Dead End Boys at the Berkeley Front. New Dodge Lounge on the June 29th is Suburban Sun and the Canastas with Steve R. Trent. And then July 6th, the Chop Tops happening at Smalls. And, of course, we cannot forget about September 25th when Frantic Flintstones are actually coming into the Detroit area playing at Smalls. And the Rumblesville is happening June 16th. Crazy all-day event happening at the Machine Shop in Flint, so be sure to look into that information and check back with the Wrecking Hours next week. We'll have more information for you, and we'll keep you posted as everything that's happening around in town for Rockabilly and Psychabilly. That's it. Here's one from the Coffin Cats, and I'm out of here.
HFR, Dearborn.
Mom, Dad, I'm in eighth grade now. That means those years of peer pressure are way behind me. From here on out, It's all about good grades and living up to your totally realistic expectations. Alcohol is probably the last thing on my mind. Like you said, I'm too young to drink. When I'm with my friends, all we talk about are current events and boy bands. We're definitely not curious about what alcohol tastes like or why the older kids drink. And do I notice when you have a drink at dinner? Of course not. Just like I haven't noticed where you keep the alcohol. Oh, and if the opportunity arises to talk to me about drinking, you should definitely continue to avoid it. And if you do bring it up, just remind me that I'm too young. That'll probably do the trick.
Real kids are curious about alcohol. 40% try it by the 8th grade. Start a real conversation at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov. Talk early, talk often, get others involved. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
The Trade and Apprentice Education Division of the Henry Ford Community College is excited to present a new 10-credit-hour renewable energy certificate program. The content of the courses will be structured to inform the students of both present and future renewable energy concepts. This certificate program should interest students who are looking for an alternative to our current reliance on fossil fuels. To learn more about this program, please contact the Trade and Apprentice Education Division at 313-845-9609 or on the internet at www.hfcc.edu.
Blues with the feeling is good for your heart. I'm no doctor, but I have a prescription for the blues. Keep it locked to WHFR, the only station making waves. Hi, I'm Anderson Coleman. Listen to me every Saturday on 89.3 FM from 4 to 6 p.m.
Get over it, girl. What's done is done. When you lost a good man, I sure found one. The way you treated him.
Disclaimer. This show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Maggie Kurth Baker about her new book, Before the Lights Go Out, Conquering the Energy Crisis Before It Conquers Us. We'll also hear from Jim Robbins about his book, The Man Who Planted Trees, and get some green living tips from Avital Binstock, the green lifestyle editor at Sierra Magazine. Joining us now over the phone is Maggie Kurth Baker, the author of a new book called Before the Lights Go Out, Conquering the Energy Crisis Before It Conquers Us. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Maggie, let's start just by talking a little bit about your background and what made you decide to write a book on this topic.
Well, so I'm a science journalist, and I'm actually married to a guy who does energy engineering for commercial buildings. So what my husband does is figure out ways to make buildings as energy efficient as possible for the least amount of money. And in the course of having these conversations with him about, you know, what he was doing at work and about different clients he was dealing with, it started to occur to me that there was this big gap between what energy experts knew about how energy worked and what, you know, lay people and also, you know, the politicians and people making decisions about energy knew about what and how energy worked. And so one of the things I really tried to do with my writing as a science journalist is kind of make these connections and help people understand these broader contexts of the things that they read about day to day in the newspaper. So that's really what I was trying to do with this book, was to, you know, help people pull out from all of those tiny little individual stories and see what all of these projects are adding up to and how they're really shaping what's going to happen over the next 30 or 40 years.
One of the key ideas in your book is the fact that energy is more than sources, it's systems.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would be helpful to talk a little bit with our listeners about, you know, what the electric grid is and how it works. Because it's a topic that, you know, people say, oh, the electric grid all the time. And I think for most of us, we don't really think about what that means or what it is.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it's definitely one of those things that is really invisible to our lives in a surprising way, because I think we're all used to having, you know, gasoline being this very visceral part of our daily lives. You know, you spill gasoline on your shoes every day when you're at the gas pump. But electricity doesn't work that way. And electricity tends to be like this strange, you know, little elves that live in the wall, and they just turn on the light when you flip a light switch. So to kind of talk a little bit about what the grid is, the way I kind of try to explain it to people is that it's a lot like a lazy river at a water park. It's not just one line or a couple of, you know, electric wires. It's this loop of wires. You have to connect the power plant to the customers and then back around to the power plant again. You have to have that entire circuit connected, or you're going to get blackouts. And at the same time, just like a lazy river, the electric grid has to function within these certain parameters. So the electricity that moves along it has to move at a constant speed, which is analogous to what engineers would call frequency. And it has to move at a constant depth, which is analogous to voltage. And you get that constant speed and that constant depth by maintaining an almost perfect balance between electric supply and electric demand. That basically, you know, any minute, every minute by minute on the electric grid, we have to have that balance happening. You can't let one get much out of whack. I mean, even a fraction of a percent of a difference can kind of start heading you towards blackouts.
So how does that infrastructure affect things like wind and solar and energy efficiency as we begin to explore those options for taking dirtier forms of energy like coal plants offline?
The biggest effect, I think, about it is on wind and solar. Because this grid that we have, it wasn't designed by anybody. It kind of evolved piecemeal over the years. It's really a lot like a house that's been kind of remodeled by various people over 100 years. And so there was never any time that somebody sat down and thought, you know, how can we make this work as best as it possibly can? So you have this system that evolved, and it co-evolved with sources of energy like natural gas and coal and nuclear power and hydroelectric power. And all of those things, to varying degrees, can be controlled. You can decide we're going to produce a set amount of electricity at a certain time of day, and they can do that. And if you need to adjust that, you can call them up and say, you know, we need you to produce more electricity. And to varying degrees, all of those different types of power plants can, you know, obey those commands. Wind and solar are a little bit different, because wind and solar can only produce as much electricity as the resource is available. So you can't really say we'll produce set amount of electricity at this wind farm at a set day, because you don't know exactly how much wind you're going to have. And if you don't have enough wind, you can't call that power plant up later and ask them to produce more electricity. So it adds this level of instability into a system that's already a little bit unstable. And that kind of can produce some problems. It's not something that's a huge issue. It's not something that means we shouldn't invest in wind and solar right now. But what experts have told me is that we can get between 20 and 30% of our electric capacity from wind and solar power before we're going to need to make some big changes to the way that the grid operates. Because otherwise, as you get, you know, into that region, it just becomes a little bit harder and a little bit harder and a little bit harder to maintain that balance between supply and demand.
So, in other words, it shouldn't be an excuse that people are using to not put wind and solar online now, because most of the states, I think except for Iowa and either North or South Dakota, no state is currently getting 20% of their energy from wind and solar yet. I know Iowa is, so they've shown that it's possible, but other states still have a ways to go.
Yeah, you know, I think Texas has the highest installed grid wind capacity of any state, but they're not getting 20% of their electricity from wind. And I know Minnesota and some of those places are getting closer, but it's more of something that's going to kind of happen when you can't outsource the balancing of the grid to other parts of the country. It becomes more of a problem as more places closer to one another have these kind of levels of wind and solar. So, yeah, it definitely shouldn't be something where we're using that as an excuse not to invest, because it's something that needs to happen, both in terms of we need more wind and solar on the grid, and also in terms of these changes that we would make to accommodate wind and solar. Well, they're good for the grid for other reasons, too. you know, right now we have a lot of risks that we have to face with how our grid operates, simply because it has that instability already built into it that has nothing to do with wind and solar. A good example of that is Texas. I believe last winter had a couple of cold snaps that they weren't expecting, and the people who manage the balance between supply and demand on the grid weren't expecting it to get that cold. And so there was this increase in electric demand that people weren't expecting. And at the same time, that cold weather froze the pipes on a couple of coal-fired power plants, so took production out that they were expecting they would have. And because they'd had more demand and not enough supply, they had blackouts all over the place.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the historical content from your book, you know, the founding of the earliest grids and some of the stories that show the history of this system. I think our listeners might want to hear more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some really interesting stories about this because I think, you know, if you're anything like me, most of what you've heard is about Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla and, like, all those big famous stories about the beginnings of electricity. But there's some really interesting stuff that was happening behind the scenes as well. And one of the things that I ran across was Appleton, Wisconsin, which it turns out was the location of the second centralized electric grid in the entire world, and also the site of the first hydroelectric power plant in the entire world. And more importantly, this was the first place that somebody who wasn't Thomas Edison and didn't have Thomas Edison's whole team of geniuses working with him tried to take this technology and really put it to use in a practical way, and kind of ended up failing miserably, actually.
Tell us more about that.
It's really interesting, and I told you that the grid always has to have that balance between supply and demand. But H.J. Rogers, who was the businessman that tried to build this first grid in Appleton, he didn't know about this. He didn't really understand that it was difficult to manage a grid. So one of the things that he did, he'd had all these examples of times where he tried to cut corners and save money and build this grid faster and cheaper rather than building it well. And one of those things was he owned the paper mill in town. So he had a water wheel that was powering this paper mill. And he tried to save a little bit of cash by hooking up his electric generator to the same water wheel. But the paper mill had a lot of demand for its services. And at the time, the electric grid only had one customer, which was H.J. Rogers himself. So on the days when the paper mill was running at full capacity, that water wheel was producing way more electricity than this little electric grid needed. And so you'd have light bulbs just burning out all through H.J. Rogers' mansion. And at the time, those light bulbs cost the equivalent of $36 a pop.
Out of all the research that you did for this book, I mean, what other things really surprised you, or what really stuck in your mind as something that people don't think about or don't know when they think about how our whole system functions?
I think one of the things that was most surprising to me was that there's not really storage on the electric grid. You know, we have these lives that are just chock full of batteries. There's a battery in the cordless phone I'm using right now, and my cell phone, and my computer, just everything. And there's not really batteries built into the grid. It's just one of those things where we've never installed storage capacity into it. So that balance between supply and demand actually has to be physically maintained. There are these guys that work in centers all over the country whose job it is to, you know, be there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, making sure that the amount of electricity being generated always almost perfectly matches the demand being pulled off of the grid. It'd be a lot easier to maintain that balance, and our grid would be a lot more secure if we had storage built in. But we don't, simply because storage has been historically really expensive. The batteries that are most being used right now in kind of demonstration projects are called sodium-sulfur batteries, and they're each about the size of a semi-truck, and they each cost several millions of dollars, and they have to be shipped over from Japan because there's no place in the Western Hemisphere that makes them.
Anything else that you want to add for our listeners?
One of the things that I came up with that I think is really important, and that I had to kind of change how I thought about energy to really grasp, was the importance of these structural and systems-level changes compared to the kind of changes that you and I can do at home. Because, you know, I grew up, I'm 30 years old, I grew up with the whole 101 things you can do to save the earth kind of mentality. But then you look at how these systems that we live in incentivize certain behaviors and decentivize other behaviors. And it becomes really clear that we have to change those systems before we can expect people to make the individual changes. So, I mean, to give you an example, I live in Minneapolis, and I can step out my front door, and I can get on a bus that will take me anywhere I want to go in the city, or we have these great bicycle trails through the city, too. You know, I can hop on a bicycle trail a half mile from my house and bike out to my in-law's house 30 miles away, and I only cross, you know, streets, I think, twice. So we have this infrastructure, and because we have this infrastructure, my husband and I, we only share one car. We don't have to drive very much in the summer at all. But most Americans don't live that way. You know, if I went down to Kansas City, where a lot of my family is from, they don't have much of a bus system, and they don't have much of a bike system. So if I told them they should only own one car and they shouldn't drive as much, I'm kind of telling them to shoot themselves in the foot, because without those things, you know, they can't access their jobs, they can't access the services they need and want, they can't really even participate in their communities. So that really drove home to me how important it is to change the systems that we live in and the infrastructures that we live in, because those are the things that are going to incentivize people to make the decisions that save energy and that use energy in a responsible way.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Maggie Kurth-Baker on her book, Before the Lights Go Out, Conquering the Energy Crisis Before It Conquers Us. And for more information, you can look at her website at maggiekb.com/books. We're here now with Jim Robbins, the author of a new book called The Man Who Planted Trees. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Jim, I know that there's been some buzz around your book, especially because of this moving op-ed that you wrote in the New York Times recently. In that op-ed, one of the things you talk about is that there's so much we don't know when it comes to trees and to forests. I'm wondering if you wanted to start by talking a little bit about what we don't know before we talk about some of the things that we do know. And why does that matter?
Well, it matters because we don't know what's happening with climate change and trees. We simply don't have a lot of good baseline data around forests. They haven't been studied that long. And so scientists can't even say something as basic as if more trees are dying these days, because there's no recordation of what's happened in a century ago, for example. So we're having a mass kill-off of trees in the West, the Rocky Mountain West, an even bigger die-off of trees in Canada because of a pine bark beetle that's gotten a lot more widespread because of a warmer climate. And they can't even tell you how that compares to 100 years ago or 200 years ago, or certainly going back longer than that. So we're in this kind of conundrum when it comes to trees without having data to verify some of the things that we seem to think are going on.
Let's go back to this beetle for a moment. I know there are some people who know a lot about this, but for others, it may seem surprising that the biggest problem for our forest these days is not logging, but actually, you know, the trees are dying because of this beetle. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I'll give you an example from my own property. I have about 15 acres near Helena, Montana, and many of the trees, ponderosa pines there, were 300 or 400 years old. Well, in 2005, they started dying, and by 3 years later, they were all dead. I mean, we're talking about thousands of trees. And the reason they died is because of a beetle that burrows into pine trees and lays its eggs. And when the eggs hatch, the larva circle the tree, cut off the tree from the roots, and essentially kill it. And these bugs are a necessary part of the ecology, but there are so many of them these days because of a warmer climate that they're much more widespread. And, of course, trees are much more stressed because the growing season is longer and moisture hasn't changed to accommodate the longer growing season. So trees are very stressed. And so these bugs are having just one heck of an impact from the Mexican border up into Canada, just eating trees and killing them. And no one's ever seen anything like it in terms of how widespread these die-offs are.
Let's change gears a little bit here for a minute. Now, your book focuses on the story of a man who's on a mission to reverse the effects of climate change by cloning the world's biggest and oldest trees. So tell us a little bit more about his story and how he began this work.
Well, in 2001, I wrote a piece for the New York Times science section on the Champion Tree Project, and they had a plan to clone some of the largest trees in the country to protect the genetics, figuring that these things had survived for so long that there must be something to the genes, in their genes, that helped them survive. Again, one of those things that isn't well studied is tree genetics, if it's studied at all, and they don't know why these trees have lived so long. So his plan, his name is David Millark. He's a shade tree farmer from Michigan. He didn't know anything about the science. He just said, let's protect them. And so they cloned a lot of the oak trees and ash trees in Michigan where he lives. And by cloning, they just take a cutting and they scrape off a little bit at the bottom and they root it. It's not a clone like Dolly the sheep. It's just a horticultural clone. So he made these copies and then he would plant them different places to protect the genetics, figuring if climate change came and killed some of these big old trees, we'd still have this genetic library. And a number of the scientists I spoke to said, this is a good idea. We should protect these genetics. We don't know what's there. And so he started doing this, and I wrote a story about it. And a few months later, I met David Millark, and he told me the story that he had had a near-death experience, which I'd never heard of, and that in a sense, he'd left his body and came back, and one of the missions that he came back with was to clone these trees, and that's how the project came to be. And after talking with a number of scientists, they said, well, we don't know much about the near-death experience part of it, but cloning these trees makes a lot of sense. And so I pursued this, and as I did, and my own trees died and other trees died, like the bristlecone pines that are the oldest trees in the world that are dying in some of these high mountain areas, started to make a lot of sense as a way to tell the story of how little we know about trees and how important they might be.
What did you find most amazing about trees in your research? What are some of the things you think our listeners would be surprised to hear about trees?
Well, I think the main thing I learned is how little we know, but we've already talked about that. But I think some of the other things that are really critical is the trees are a filter system. The leaves filter out air pollutants that we cannot filter out with man-made technologies. There are correlations that show that the more tree canopy in city areas, the less incidence of asthma, for example. Trees take in these microparticles and hold them and prevent us from breathing those things in. Trees filter water. I mean, that's one of their most robust ecosystem services. They use willows. People use willows and poplar trees in large fields in order to clean up toxic waste site, to clean up explosives, to clean up toxic cleaning fluid that's been spilled, to clean up petroleum. I mean, it's amazing what a tree can do with very toxic chemicals and not only survive it, not only clean it up, but survive using these chemicals, neutralizing it. And it does this by taking in these chemicals through a very densely packed a zone around the roots where there are a lot of microbes that take in water for the tree, clean it, and in exchange the tree exudes what's called an exudate, a sugar that these microbes live on. So we're tapping into this natural process and using them to clean up some of our most toxic chemicals. Trees, I mean, if you look at it, trees take sunlight and they turn it into fruit and nuts and wood for building and burning and those types of things. And so that's even a miracle in itself if we think about it that way. Basically, I think trees are an ecotechnology that we could not mimic if we tried. They do so many things. They carry out all these functions, and they self-replicate to boot. And it's really quite amazing if you frame it in this way as opposed to just thinking about a tree as a stick with leaves.
Is there anything else you want to add for our listeners?
Yes. I think that trees, there's a concept, just like a working dog. We can have a dog as a pet, or we can have a dog that can herd cattle, that can help blind people navigate through a city. Just like there are working dogs, there are working trees. We can take them and we can apply them to some of our thorniest environmental problems, whether it's cleaning up the fertilizers that run off the cornfields of mid-America and cause dead zones in the ocean, or whether it's cleaning up toxic waste. We've barely tapped into this ability of trees to to help us get out of some of these problems. And I think there's a lot of room for exploration there.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today. You've been listening to Jim Robbins talking about his new book, The Man Who Planted Trees. And for more information, you can visit www.jim-robbins.net. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Binshtok, the Green Living editor of Sierra Magazine and also the editor of our Green Life blog. Welcome.
Thanks, Orly. Good to be here.
Today we're going to talk about greening your hotel stay.
Yes.
We've talked about lots of different greening tips over the years, but I don't think we've ever talked about how to green your stay in a hotel. So what are some of your quick and easy tips for our listeners about that?
Right. Yeah, we haven't talked about this before, but, you know, I noticed that travelers, even eco-conscious ones, tend to check in the hotel or go on vacation, and they kind of let go of their, you know, environmentally friendly habits. And so I came up with a few tips for people to keep in mind even while they travel, because, you know, the earth doesn't care if you're on vacation. So the first one are, you know, leave those little bottles that you find in your hotel room. A lot of people have the urge to kind of swoop them all up and throw them in the suitcase and hope that housekeeping replaces them with new ones.
Now, you mean the shampoo bottles, not the little mini vodka bottles.
No. Yeah, I meant the shampoo bottles and the wrapped bar soaps, for that matter, too. Mm-hmm. So all the little toiletries, you know, they're fun to take, but really what people need to think about is that they do exact a cost on the planet. Producing them requires resources, emits pollution, transporting them burns fossil fuels, and their packaging is likely to end up in a landfill. So when we suggested this on our blog, we had some readers write in and give some of their suggestions. Some of them actually carry their own toiletries while they travel. That way they don't even have to open the little bottles in the hotel rooms so that they don't have to get replaced. And, you know, the bar soaps, if you don't bring a bar soap with you and you do open a bar soap in the hotel, consider bringing a little container with you to put that into, because otherwise it'll be used once or twice by you and then housekeeping has to throw it away. So imagine all the bar soaps that get sent to the landfill that really were just used once or twice. It's a big waste.
Other tips for your hotel room greening?
Yeah. So one thing I notice when I walk into hotel rooms often is it's freezing when you walk in the room. It's like stepping onto the tundra. So I would say readjust the thermostat as soon as you take ownership of your room. The Department of Energy has a suggestion of setting air conditioning temperatures to no lower than 78 degrees when you're there and higher when you're sleeping or when you're out. One of our readers piped up on this tip too and suggested even sticking a note on the thermostat telling housekeeping to leave it alone, because whenever that, you know, they go in and do anything with your room, they'll always put it back down to where the hotel says it should be, which is usually too low for most people.
And then of course there's also the issue of the sheets and towels. I know most hotels now have those little forms that you can leave out that tell people not to, you know, that tells housekeeping they don't have to change it every day. I mean, what are your recommendations around that?
That's right. You can use that little form. And you can also just keep the do not disturb sign on the door, you know, even when you're out, so that they don't change the sheets or towels after you've only used them once. They don't mess with the air conditioner. They don't use the energy for vacuuming. They don't use the chemical-based cleaning materials. Because how dirty really are you going to get the place in one day? You don't change the sheets every single day at your home.
What about finding the green hotel to begin with? I mean, we know some hotels are greener than others.
Yeah, that's a good point. So even if you're turning off all the lights whenever you leave the room, even if you're lowering the AC, even if you're leaving the little soaps, you may still be doing harm unknowingly just by giving your business to a place that burns through energy or pollutes water or produces tons of waste. So to make sure that the property that you're giving your money to is environmentally responsible, a good way to make sure of that is to look for certification. So there are LEED certified hotels now. There aren't too many out there. There are only around 80 that currently exist, although a lot more are forthcoming, or a lot more applying for that certification. Another one to look for is the Green Seal. Some hotels have the Green Seal. Another indication is if they're Energy Star compliant, they'll usually advertise that. So look for some official certification that tells you that their eco practices really are legitimate.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Avital Binshtok, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine and also for the Green Life blog. And for more green tips, you can check out the Green Life blog at sierraclub.org/greenlife.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
I wanted to talk to you today about creative confidence. I'm going to start way back in the third grade at Oakdale School in Barberton, Ohio. I remember one day my best friend Brian was working on a project. He was making a horse out of the clay that our teacher kept under the sink. And at one point, one of the girls that was sitting at his table, seeing what he was doing, leaned over and said to him, "That's terrible. That doesn't look anything like a horse." Right? And Brian's shoulders sank, and he wadded up the clay horse, and he threw it back in the bin. I kind of never saw Brian do a project like that ever again. And I wonder how often that happens, you know? It seems like when I tell that story of Brian to my class, you see, a lot of them want to come up after class and tell me about their similar experience, how a teacher shut them down or how a student was particularly cruel to them. And they some kind of opt out of thinking of themselves as creative at that point, right? And I see that opting out that happens in childhood, and it moves in and becomes more ingrained even by the time you get to adult life. So we see a lot of this. You know, when we have a workshop or we have clients in to work with us side by side, eventually we get to the point in the process that's kind of fuzzy or unconventional. And eventually these big shot executives whip out their Blackberries and they say they have to make really important phone calls and they head for the exits. And they're just so uncomfortable. When we track them down and ask them what's going on, they say something like, "I'm just not the creative type." But we know that's not true. If they stick with the process, if they stick with it, they end up doing amazing things. And they surprise themselves just how innovative they and their teams really are. So I've been looking at this kind of fear of judgment that we have, you know, that you don't do things, you're afraid you're going to be judged. If you don't, you know, say the right creative thing, you're going to be judged. And I had a major breakthrough when I met the psychologist, Albert Bandura. I don't know if you know Albert Bandura, but if you go to Wikipedia, it says that he's the fourth most important psychologist in history. You know, like Freud, Skinner, somebody in Bandura. Bandura is 86 and he still works at Stanford. He's just a lovely guy. And so I went to see him because he's just worked on phobias for a long time, which I'm very interested in. He had developed this methodology that it ended up curing people in a very short amount of time. Like in 4 hours, he had a huge cure rate of people who had phobias. And we talked about snakes. I don't know why we talked about snakes. We talked about snakes and fear of snakes as a phobia. And it was really enjoyable, really interesting. He told me that he'd invite the test subject in, and he'd say, "You know, there's a snake in the next room, and we're going to go in there." And to which he reported that most of them replied, "Hell no, I'm not going in there. Certainly if there's a snake in there." But Bandura has a kind of a step-by-step process that was super successful. So he'd take people to this like two-way mirror looking into the room where the snake was, and he'd get them comfortable with that. And then through a series of steps, he'd move them, and they'd be standing in the doorway with the door open, and they'd be looking in there, and he'd get them comfortable with that. And then many more steps later, kind of baby steps, they'd be in the room, they'd have like a leather glove, like a welder's glove on, and they'd eventually touch the snake. And when they touched the snake, everything was fine. They were cured. In fact, everything was better than fine. These people who had lifelong fears of snakes were saying things like, "Look how beautiful that snake is," and they were holding it in their laps. Right? Bandura calls this process guided mastery. I love that term, guided mastery, right? And something else happened. These people who went through the process and touched the snake ended up having less anxiety about other things in their lives, right? They tried harder, they persevered longer, and they were more resilient in the face of failure, right? They just gained a new confidence. And Bandura calls that confidence self-efficacy, right? The sense that you can change the world and that you can attain what you set out to do. Well, meeting Bandura was really cathartic for me because I realized that this, you know, famous scientist had documented and scientifically validated something that we've seen happen over, you know, for the last 30 years, that we could take people who had the fear that they weren't creative, and we could take them through a series of steps, kind of like a series of small successes, and they turned kind of fear into familiarity, and they surprised themselves. The transformation is amazing. We see it at the D School now all the time. People from all different kinds of disciplines, they think of themselves as only analytical, and they come in, and they go through the process, our process, they build confidence, and now they think of themselves differently. And they're totally emotionally excited about the fact that they walk around thinking of themselves as a creative person, right? So I thought one of the things I'd do today is take you through, like, and show you what this journey looks like. To me, that journey looks like Doug Dietz. Doug Dietz is a technical person. He designs medical imaging equipment, large medical imaging equipment. He's worked for GE, and he's had a fantastic career. But at one point, he had a moment of crisis. He was in the hospital looking at one of his MRI machines in use when he saw a young family and his little girl. And that little girl was crying and was terrified. And Doug was really disappointed to learn that nearly 80% of the pediatric patients in this hospital had to be sedated in order to deal with this MRI machine, right? And this was really disappointing to Doug because before this time, he was proud of what he did. You know, he was saving lives with this machine. But it really hurt him to see the fear that this machine caused in kids. About that time, he was at the D School at Stanford taking classes. He was learning about our process, about design thinking, about empathy, about iterative prototyping. And he would take this new knowledge and do something quite extraordinary. He would redesign the entire experience of being scanned. And this is what he came up with. He turned it into an adventure for the kids. He painted the walls and he painted the machine and he got the operators retrained by people who know kids, like, you know, children's museum people. And now, so when the kid comes, it's an experience. And they talk to him about the noise and the movement of the ship. And when they come, they say, okay, you're going to go into the pirate ship, but be very still because we don't want the pirates to find you. Right? And the results were super dramatic. Right? So from something like 80% of the kids needing to be sedated to something like 10% of the kids needing to be sedated. And the hospital and GE were happy too because you didn't have to call the anesthesiologist all the time, they could put more kids through the machine in a day. So the quantitative results were great. But Doug's results that he cared about were much more qualitative. He was with one of the mothers waiting for her child to come out of the scan. And when the little girl came out of her scan, she ran up to her mother and said, Mommy, can we come back tomorrow? Right? And so I've heard Doug tell the story many times of his personal transformation and the breakthrough design that happened from it. But I've never really seen him tell the story of the little girl without a tear in his eye. Doug's story takes place in a hospital. I know a thing or two about hospitals. A few years ago, I felt a lump on the side of my neck. And it was my turn in the MRI machine. It was cancer. It was the bad kind. I was told I had like a 40% chance of survival. So while you're sitting around like with the other patients in your pajamas and everybody's pale and thin, you know, and you're waiting for your turn to get the gamma rays, you think of a lot of things. Most of you think about, am I going to survive? And I thought a lot about, what was my daughter's life going to be like without me? But think about other things. I thought a lot about, what was I put on earth to do? You know, what was my calling? What should I do? Right? And I was lucky because I had lots of options. We'd been working in health and wellness and K through 12 and the developing world, and so there were lots of projects that I could work on. But I decided, and I committed to at this point, that the thing I most wanted to do was to help as many people as possible regain the creative confidence they lost along their way. And if I was going to survive, that's what I wanted to do. I survived, just so you know. I really believe that when people gain this confidence, and we see it all the time at the D School and at IDEO, that they actually start working on the things that are really important in their lives. We see people quit what they're doing and go in new directions. We see them come up with more interesting and more ideas so that they can choose from better ideas. And they just make better decisions. So I know at TED you're supposed to have a change the world kind of thing, isn't that? Everybody has a change the world thing. If there is one for me, this is it, to help this happen. So I hope you'll join me on my quest. You as kind of thought leaders, it would be really great if you didn't let people divide the world into the creatives and the non-creatives like it's some God-given thing. And to have people realize that they're naturally creative, you know, and that those natural people should let their ideas fly. That they should achieve what Bandura calls self-efficacy, that you can do what you set out to do, and that you can reach a place of creative confidence and touch the snake. Thank you.
Talk to you about optimism, or more precisely, the optimism bias. It's a cognitive illusion that we've been studying in my lab for the past few years, and 80% of us have it. It's our tendency to overestimate our likelihood of experiencing good events in our lives and underestimate our likelihood of experiencing bad events. So we underestimate our likelihood of suffering from cancer, being in a car accident, we overestimate our longevity, our career prospects. In short, we're more optimistic than realistic, but we are oblivious to the fact. Take marriage, for example. In the Western world, divorce rates are about 40%. That means that out of 5 married couples, 2 will end up splitting their assets. But when you ask newlyweds about their own likelihood of divorce, they estimate it at 0%. And even divorce lawyers, who should really know better, hugely underestimate their own likelihood of divorce. So it turns out that optimists are not less likely to divorce, but they are more likely to remarry. In the words of Samuel Johnson, remarriage is a triumph of hope over experience. So if we're married, we're more likely to have kids, and we all think our kids will be especially talented. This, by the way, is my 2-year-old nephew, Guy, and I just want to make it absolutely clear that he's a really bad example of the optimism bias, because he is, in fact, uniquely talented. And I'm not alone. Out of 4 British people, 3 said that they were optimistic about the future of their own families. That's 75%. But only 30% said that they thought families in general are doing better than a few generations ago. And this is a really important point, because we're optimistic about ourselves, we're optimistic about our kids, we're optimistic about our families, but we're not so optimistic about the guy sitting next to us, and we're somewhat pessimistic about the fate of our fellow citizens and the fate of our country. But private optimism about our own personal future remains persistent. And it doesn't mean that we think things will just like magically turn out okay, but rather that we have the unique ability to make it so. Now, I'm a scientist, I do experiments. So to show you what I mean, I'm gonna do an experiment here with you. Okay? So I'm going to give you a list of abilities and characteristics, and I want you to think for each of these abilities where you stand relative to the rest of the population. The first one is getting along well with others. Who here believes they're at the bottom 25%? Okay, that's about 10 people out of 1,500, I think. Who believes they're at the top 25%? That's most of us here. Okay, now do the same for your driving ability. How interesting are you? How attractive are you? How honest are you? And finally, how modest are you? So most of us put ourselves above average on most of these abilities. Now, this is statistically impossible. We can't all be better than everyone else. But if we believe we're better than the other guy, well, that means that we're more likely to get that promotion, to remain married, because we're more social, more interesting. And it's a global phenomena. The optimism bias has been observed in many different countries, in Western cultures, in non-Western cultures, in females and males, in kids, in the elderly. It's quite widespread. But the question is it good for us? So some people say no. Some people say the secret to happiness is low expectations. I think the logic goes something like this. If we don't expect greatness, if we don't expect to find love and be healthy and successful, well, we're not going to be disappointed when these things don't happen. And if we're not disappointed when good things don't happen and we're pleasantly surprised when they do, we will be happy. So it's a very good theory, but it turns out to be wrong for three reasons. Number one, whatever happens, whether you succeed or you fail, people with high expectations always feel better. Because how we feel when we get dumped or win Employee of the Month depends on how we interpret that event. The psychologists Margaret Marshall and John Brown studied students with high and low expectations. And they found that when people with high expectations succeed, they attribute that success to their own traits. I'm a genius, therefore I got an A, therefore I'll get an A again and again in the future. When they failed, it wasn't because they were dumb, but because the exam just happened to be unfair. Next time they will do better. People with low expectations did the opposite. So when they failed, it was because they were dumb, and when they succeeded, it was because the exam just happened to be really easy. Next time reality would catch up with them. So they felt worse. Number two, regardless of the outcome, the pure act of anticipation makes us happy. The behavioral economist George Lowenstein asked students in his university to imagine getting a passionate kiss from a celebrity, any celebrity. Then he said, "How much are you willing to pay to get a kiss from a celebrity if the kiss was delivered immediately, in 3 hours, in 24 hours, in 3 days, in 1 year, in 10 years? He found that the students were willing to pay the most not to get a kiss immediately, but to get a kiss in 3 days. They were willing to pay extra in order to wait. Now, they weren't willing to wait a year or 10 years. I mean, no one wants an aging celebrity, but 3 days seemed to be the optimum amount. So why is that? Well, if you get the kiss now, it's over and done with. But if you get the kiss in 3 days, well, that's 3 days of jittery anticipation, the thrill of the wait. The students wanted that time to imagine where is it going to happen, how is it going to happen. Anticipation made them happy. This is, by the way, why people prefer Friday to Sunday. It's a really curious fact, because Friday is a day of work and Sunday is a day of pleasure, so you would assume that people will prefer Sunday, but they don't. It's not because they really, really like being in the office and they can't stand strolling in the park or having a lazy brunch. We know that because when you ask people about their ultimate favorite day of the week, surprise, surprise, Saturday comes in at first, then Friday, then Sunday. People prefer Friday because Friday brings with it the anticipation of the weekend ahead, all the plans that you have. On Sunday, the only thing you can look forward to is a work week. So optimists are people who expect more kisses in their future, more strolls in the park, and that anticipation enhances their well-being. In fact, without the optimism bias, we would all be slightly depressed. People with mild depression, they don't have a bias when they look into the future. They're actually more realistic than people, healthy individuals. But individuals with severe depression, they have a pessimistic bias. So they tend to expect the future to be worse than it ends up being. So optimism changes subjective reality. The way we expect the world to be changes the way we see it. But it also changes objective reality. It acts as a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that is the third reason why lowering your expectations will not make you happy. Controlled experiments have shown that optimism is not only related to success, it leads to success. Optimism leads to success in academia, in sports, in politics. And maybe the most surprising benefit of optimism is health. If we expect the future to be bright, stress and anxiety are reduced. So, all in all, optimism has lots of benefits. But the question that was really confusing to me was, how do we maintain optimism in the face of reality? As a neuroscientist, this was especially confusing because, according to all the theories out there, when your expectations are not met, you should alter them. But this is not what we find. We asked people to come into our lab in order to try and figure out what was going on. We asked them to estimate their likelihood of experiencing different terrible events in their lives. So, for example, what is your likelihood of suffering from cancer? And then we told them the average likelihood of someone like them to suffer these misfortunes. So cancer, for example, is about 30%. And then we asked them again, how likely are you to suffer from cancer? What we wanted to know was whether people will take the information that we gave them to change their beliefs. And indeed, they did. But mostly when the information we gave them was better than what they expected. So for example, if someone said, my likelihood of suffering from cancer is about 50%, and we said, hey, good news, the average likelihood is only 30%, the next time around, they would say, well, maybe my likelihood is about 35%. So they learned quickly and efficiently. But if someone started off saying, my average likelihood of suffering from cancer is about 10%, and we said, hey, bad news, the average likelihood is about 30%, the next time around, they would say, yep, still think it's about 11%. So it's not that they didn't learn at all, they did, but much, much less than when we gave them positive information about the future. And it's not that they didn't remember the numbers that we gave them. Everyone remembered that the average likelihood of cancer is about 30%, and the average likelihood of divorce is about 40%, but they didn't think that those numbers were related to them. What this means is that warning signs, such as these, may only have limited impact. Yes, smoking kills, but mostly kills the other guy. What I wanted to know was, what was going on inside the human brain that prevented us from taking these warning signs personally? But at the same time, when we hear that the housing market is hopeful, we think, oh, my house is definitely going to double in price. To try and figure that out, I asked the participants in the experiment to lie in a brain imaging scanner. It looks like this. And using a method called functional MRI, we were able to identify regions in the brain that were responding to positive information. One of these regions is called the left inferior frontal gyrus. So if someone said, my likelihood of suffering from cancer is 50%, and we said, hey, good news, average likelihood is 30%, the left inferior frontal gyrus would respond fiercely. And it didn't matter if you were an extreme optimist, a mild optimist, or slightly pessimistic, everyone's left inferior frontal gyrus was functioning perfectly well, whether you're Barack Obama or Woody Allen. On the other side of the brain, the right inferior frontal gyrus was responding to bad news. And here's the thing, it wasn't doing a very good job. The more optimistic you were, the less likely this region was to respond to unexpected negative information. And if your brain is failing at integrating bad news about the future, you will constantly leave your rose-tinted spectacles on. So we wanted to know, then, safe decisions. This captain is going to use our findings on the optimism bias to try to explain to the firefighters why they think the way they do, to make them acutely aware of this very optimistic bias in humans. So unrealistic optimism can lead to risky behavior, to financial collapse, to faulty planning. The British government, for example, has acknowledged that the optimism bias can make individuals more likely to underestimate the costs and durations of projects. So they have adjusted the 2012 Olympic budget for the optimism bias. My friend who's getting married in a few weeks has done the same for his wedding budget. And by the way, when I asked him about his own likelihood of divorce, he said he was quite sure it was 0%. So what we would really like to do is we would like to protect ourselves from the dangers of optimism, but at the same time remain hopeful, benefiting from the many fruits of optimism. And I believe there's a way for us to do that. The key here really is knowledge. We're not born with an innate understanding of our biases. These have to be identified by scientific investigation. But the good news is that becoming aware of the optimism bias does not shatter the illusion. It's like visual illusions, in which understanding them does not make them go away. And this is good because it means we should be able to strike a balance, to come up with plans and rules to protect ourselves from unrealistic optimism, but at the same time remain hopeful. I think this cartoon portrays it nicely, because if you're one of these pessimistic penguins up there who just does not believe they can fly, you will certainly never will. Because to make any kind of progress, we need to be able to imagine a different reality, and then we need to believe that that reality is possible. But if you are an extreme optimistic penguin who just jumps down blindly and hoping for the best, you might find yourself in a bit of a mess when you hit the ground. But if you're an optimistic penguin who believes they can fly but then adjusts a parachute to your back just in case things don't work out exactly as you planned, you will soar like an eagle, even if you're just a penguin. Thank you.
Disclaimer. This show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those.
Once again, the Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market returns to bring in support of local farmers and entrepreneurs right to the heart of Dearborn. Beginning May the 25th, over 30 Michigan vendors will be selling some of the finest seasonal products, from produce goods and flowers to garden art and woodworkings. This will also mark additional times for the market. Tuesday evenings, June 19th, July 17th, and August the 21st. The Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market will be open every Friday starting May the 25th from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. and is located on West Michigan Avenue between Mason and Howard.